Welcome to another Off the Chain with Dave and Steele. This week, for the second week in a row, we got someone extra with us.
Spencer, my freshman year roommate, back on the show, back in our hearts.
Here I am. I believe I have the distinction of being the first repeat guest on the show.
First treepeat. Threepeat, yeah, I mean.
This is your third episode, Spence. Do you feel good? You feel good about all this?
I feel smarter.
Excellent. Well, the problem was after the first couple times you were on, you got a haircut, and it was really disappointing to me. So we had to wait a while to bring you back on for your hair to grow back because you looked so handsome before.
Yeah, I feel like 10 pounds lighter, though.
So Spence is now just under 100 pounds total weight.
I was going for the century mark. I made it.
Well, this week, we get to talk about a few things that I'm super into. We're going with a lot of science fiction today.
This is going to be like the nerdiest episode we've ever done. I'm so excited.
I think it is. So we're going to take some questions. Spence is going to walk a sci-fi stack exchange. I don't even really know what that means, but I'm excited. We're going to make some reading assignments for each other.
That's proper nerdy, Dave. Proper nerdy.
And I haven't. You don't even know what your assignment is, really, Steele. It's super nerdy. And then the next segment, it might even be kind of dorky. Steele's going to walk us through Would You Rather. And, of course, we'll finish up with some songs, Unchained Melodies, and Book Wisdom. I'm going to bring the Book Wisdom to you this week, and rest assured, it is super nerdy. So, Steele, recently I've just mentioned Ringworld to you a couple times, and from what I understand, you've done some reading.
Dave, you're not going to believe this, but just yesterday I finished the first Ringworld book, and I've started reading The Ringworld Engineers. I'm into it. And here's the first thing I need to talk to you about, Dave. Number one, I've been in grad school for half of my life. And for a couple years in grad school, I was friends with this guy from China. His name's Pao Lin Wu, but he goes by Louis. So I've been going to grad school with this guy named Louis Wu for years. I've been buddies with him. And I never knew that he was 250 years old and living off of booster spice.
Have you run into him since then? Have you talked to him? You're like, hey, Louis, Ringworld, man.
No, that's what I'm dying to. I'm friends with him on Facebook. He might be on a sabbatical. I don't know.
You got to message him. You got to let him know. It's important. So you went, you not only read the first book, you're going into Ringworld Engineers. What?
Oh, yeah.
Why are you back for more?
The misogyny, primarily. I really enjoyed that. The female characters are either like young, mindless idiots or ship whores, and all they want to do is have sex with the main male characters. And I just love that from my books.
I knew you would, which is why I talked to you about it.
Oh, no. Apart from the weird gender stuff that just bugs me or whatever, they're pretty interesting books. I don't understand the hard science of it, but the concept of a ring world itself was pretty awesome. And the puppeteers, they're cool. I really like Nessus.
I'm a huge fan of the puppeteers. But Steele, just for someone that's never heard of Ringworld or knows what it is, like as if you were going to explain it to Spence, what is the Ringworld?
Okay, Spence, here's the deal. The Ringworld, it's an idea, I think, based on something that was kind of hypothesized by a guy named Freeman Dyson. And what he proposed was you could build a sphere around a sun. It was sufficiently distant, and it was rotating at a sufficient speed. That whole surface of the sphere could capture all that solar radiation and could be a habitable space. And with the ring world, it's not the full sphere. It's just a super large ring. And people basically are living on the inside of this ring, and the center of the ring is a sun. And the ring is rotating super, super fast so that the centripetal force is producing gravity. And it has these huge walls so that none of the air inside can escape.
Okay.
So they've got an environment they can live in. And it's been terraformed and designed. And it's pretty fascinating.
Well, What do you think, Spence? Would you live on the Ringworld? Is that interesting to you?
Sign me up.
Yeah, it's super cool. And what happens, I'll just give away a little bit of the book, is they make it to the Ringworld, and the Ringworld, or the people living there, have lost technology. There was some type of virus or something that destroyed technology. And so they're primitives living on this gigantic Ringworld. And they can't redevelop technology because they can't like mine for minerals or fossil fuels, because if they dig deep enough, they just get down to the ring. Very
Yeah.
compelling.
So, Dave, how many of the books have you read?
And so I've read the original, of course. I read Ringworld Engineers. I think I read one more after that. But right now, Steele, because I am really cool, I'm reading the kind of the prelude to the Ringworld. I've
Ooh.
read four of these now, which
Okay, I want to read
occurred.
the prequels. Should I read them
Yeah.
after or before?
I think you're ready, like whenever, because they're great. They're a little bit less misogynistic, which I know will be a little bit off-putting for you, but for me, it makes me a little more comfortable. And it's just setting the table for what's going to happen. You learn a lot more about the puppeteers, which is an alien species with two heads, and they look kind of like sock puppets. It's terrific. It's really
The
it's
people,
great.
I'm super into the Kazin. I want to know more about the Kzinti Man Wars. Is that in the prequels?
They don't talk about those too much. They're more focused on the puppeteers and their relationship with man to a certain extent. And it, of course, in the Ringworld universe, the core of the galaxy has exploded. So at some point, everyone's going to have to flee this terrible nuclear disaster that's coming their way. And the puppeteers, they're already gone. They're way out there. So in case that wasn't nerdy enough for anybody, let's just keep going with it. Spence, let's hear about the Stack Exchange.
Yeah, so Stack Exchange is this group of websites, all with the domain name Stack Exchange. It has different areas. So there's a sci-fi. So if you type in sci-fi.stackexchange.com, this takes you to the like sci-fi area. Basically, it's a help forum. So you can post questions related to the topic of the forum, and then anybody there will give you answers. And they actually tend to be very helpful answers on a number of different things. I've asked math questions there before. I've asked cartography questions there, like different things, and people give you answers. So you can also look at all the other questions that people have asked. But there's this sci-fi Stack Exchange, which includes questions about sci-fi.
These are the important questions, then, is what you're saying.
Exactly. I was thinking we could maybe talk about some of these questions, and if we don't have answers to the questions ourselves, at the very least we can speculate as to what the answer might be.
That sounds great, Spence.
We'll start with one that I think most people will be able to identify with. This comes from Star Wars.
I've seen those.
Yes. So the question, I'll just read the question. The title is, "Did Chewbacca have a formal rank in the Alliance?" We can track Han and Luke's advancement through the ranks in the original trilogy pretty easily. What about Chewie? Did he have a formal rank? If so, what was his rank in each of the movies in the original trilogy? Or was he just an aide to Han? So do either of you have an answer?
You go for it, Steele, because mine's going to be better than yours. So you go first,
Okay.
and then I'll speak.
Okay, so I don't know as much as I ought to about Chewbacca. But I have gone on Wikipedia in the past. Every time I go to these websites, Laurel basically, she's like, "These are so nerdy. You're wasting your time reading a resource guide to an imaginary universe." But for me, it is
No,
something that's
that's
kind of
not a
fun.
waste. That's a
But in
good
any
use of
case,
your time.
so he's a Wookiee, and I believe he has some kind of like life debt that he owes to Han. Is that correct?
Yes, I believe that's accurate.
So I feel like the film treats him sort of as chattel. He's kind of like a slave. And he's great in the films, obviously, and he's wearing his armor for the Wookiee weapons that they use. They're like crossbows or something, right? But he doesn't ever seem to wear a uniform or get any ranks. And I'm wondering whether, for all of their noble ideals, the Rebel Alliance may be actually permitting slavitude or something like that. That's as far as I can go with it. And if so, I'm pretty disappointed.
My thoughts pretty much align with yours, Steele. I'm a little bit disappointed with the Alliance. Chewbacca's never given a formal command, an opportunity to show what he can do. And who is Han Solo to maintain this servitude of this
A known
fine
criminal.
being? Exactly. A smuggler? And he's like, yeah, I got a Wookiee sidekick, so what?
A murderer.
He shot Greedo. He shot him first.
That's definitely true.
And I feel like it goes, it's kind of the whole framework, the thought of these humans out there in outer space disparaging other species and not giving them their full due. It's not racism because it's a different species, it's speciesism. They don't feel like Chewbacca is worthwhile enough to really listen to him.
Yeah.
Maybe part of the problem is that it's hard to know what he's saying when all he's saying is,
hey, that didn't stop Helen Keller.
That's true.
Spence, that's the same kind of ignorant thinking that's keeping the Rebel Alliance from winning this war. Like, why are they still fighting the Empire? We already blew up the Death Star and they're still having to fight? It's because they're not thinking outside the box. They're not allowing other species to be like, yeah, maybe we should try it this way.
So what does this say about Han, though? Because, the official relationship seems to be one of master and servant, but they seem very friendly, and at the very least, Han is a very benevolent owner.
Well, because I feel like there's a bunch of fan fiction connected to Star Wars, and I feel like the backstory for Chewbacca, and this is outside of the movie, so I'm not sure how canonical it is, but I feel like he was involved in like ending slavery for some of the Wookiees who had been enslaved. So he was like an abolitionist, but he has a life debt to Han Solo, and I think that's functionally different than slavery, but I don't know how. I'm not hardcore enough.
I think in reality, Han Solo, he loves Chewbacca. He's his friend, and I don't think Han really feels like he's Chewbacca's slave master. He's almost Chewbacca is insisting on continuing to pay this life debt. So really, I don't think Han's a bad guy. I just think it's the rest of the Rebel Alliance that's not allowing a Wookiee to advance in the ranks simply because he's a Wookiee.
Yeah. Laugh it up, Fuzzball. That's such a good line.
So as far as I can tell on the entry, there is no official answer, by the way.
There's just silence.
Yeah, well,
the speciesism of the Alliance continues.
There's speculation, but it's basically, yeah, nobody really knows. So we'll go to another one now, and this is comes out of the Star Trek world. And I have to admit, I actually know basically nothing about Star Trek except for one of the reboot movies that I've seen. And the question's kind of long, so I'll paraphrase. But the title is, in the Battle of Wolf 359, one ship survives. Which one was it, and why did it survive? So the question says that there's this battle that happens, and at some point it mentions 40 ships, and then mentions that 39 of them returned. But it also says that all the ships were destroyed. So the question is basically, what happened to this one ship? Because it says there were 40, but then later it says 39 were destroyed, and it also says that all the ships were destroyed. So somehow the math doesn't add up. So I'm wondering if you might have some thoughts on what happened to that one ship.
So Steele, from what I understand, you know exactly the answer to this question. You've seen this, you know. So could you just enlighten us? Because I have some ideas, but from what I understand, you have the answer.
Oh, yeah, definitely. This has to do a lot with Jean-Luc Picard's childhood. And if you'll remember, the Kabbalistic symbology of Jean-Luc Picard, like if you take all the numbers in his name and you add them up, it actually equals 49. And the interesting thing was that Captain James Kirk, right?
Yeah, Tiberius is his middle name, yeah.
James T. Kirk, James Tiberius. If you add up the numbers for his name, it actually equals 39. So what they're saying is that if you take Picard minus Kirk, we are really left with one. But since they're both commanding the signature vessel in the Star Trek series that they are helming or captaining, they're essentially equal. So although they're not identical, they are equals. And that's why the math, 49 or 40 minus 39, it technically equals one. But within the universe of the Star Trek, they can speak in some cases about 40 being destroyed and 39 being destroyed as if it were the same. So they're not identical. So they're equal.
There was no literal survivor ship. This is like a nomenclature thing.
You know, there may have been. That's beneath me. The practicalities of this are for other people. I'm talking about the metaphysical interpretation, what it means, Spencer. Okay. I mean, Dave, do you have thoughts about the day-to-day pragmatics?
Well, yeah, it was quite the battle. It was very interesting. well done. They used what was called an expander missile. This is a missile that once it hits a craft, it actually continues to expand, and it can then destroy five crafts, how this is designed. So to be one of the 40 ships here that would survive, you either, one, have to have been the one that shot the expander missile, or you have to have jumped to hyperspace or warp speed, as is known in the Star Trek universe, at the exact moment when the missile was fired. So either you're the one firing the missile, or you know when the missile's fired. So either way, it's a little bit underhanded. Did you lead your team into an ambush? Did you know this was going to happen, or are you the person that did it? So really, it's the one that we need to go after. It's the one that we need to take down. It's the one that killed Kirk's father and Picard's father. Both their fathers were killed by this ship.
Yeah, and again, tying in the Kabbalistic influence, 4039, the missile that killed their fathers. Very Freudian.
Yeah, I'm liking these answers.
I'm only understanding every third word myself, but I'm trying to hang on.
Yeah, just fasten your seatbelts, guys. We're having a great time.
So we'll do one more here. This returns back to the Star Wars universe. The question is, why did Greedo shoot first? And it says, was there ever an explanation given by George Lucas or the studios for changing the cantina scene to Greedo firing before Han did? So to give you some background, in the original Star Wars, Han shoots Greedo before Greedo has done anything. Or at least, you know, Han shoots him before Greedo has fired his gun. But when they went back and remade the movies, they doctored up the scene so that Greedo shoots first and then Han shoots him.
Well, my main issue with Greedo shooting first is, hey Greedo, you're sitting about 5 feet away from him. If you're going to shoot first, you probably need to hit him. Like, how hard is that to shoot a blaster 5 feet and kill Han Solo? How hard is that?
You know, the other point to remember, Dave, it's not like Greedo killed people for a living. He was not a bounty hunter, or she was not a bounty hunter, was she? Yeah, they were. So, come on. Learn to use your blaster.
There are lots of controversies in the Star Wars series because George Lucas made a lot of changes when he re-released them, and many of them were not well received. Not to mention characters like Jar Jar Binks, who basically ruined the first three movies. Or, you know, he ruined the first one, and then there were other things that ruined the second and third one, namely George Lucas. But there are lots of these little things introduced in the remakes, and so this is not an isolated incident. But the reason that people care is that they don't like the idea, they kind of like the idea that Han is a bit of a rogue and kind of a killer, or that he was kind of underhanded, you know? He didn't wait to be shot at, he shot first.
Yeah, but like, isn't Greedo, even in the original, Greedo's saying, like, he literally says, I've been looking forward to killing you, right before he gets shot, right? So it's not like it's a non-threatening situation. It's not like Han's just like, oh, hey, Greedo, and assassinates him.
That's true.
Anyway.
it's all quite frustrating. I think that Lucas just wanted to kind of teddy bearize Han Solo to a certain extent. He wanted to make him a little softer, a little more huggable. And to do that, he had to not be the one to shoot first. And I think that's really the explanation. But you can't explain Greedo's inability to make a shot unless, of course, he's never shot a gun before. About a year or two ago, I took a handgun out to the desert with some friends, and I was missing things 5 feet away. But I've never fired a handgun before. Is Greedo just a rookie bounty hunter and he doesn't know what he's doing?
Greedo's like the Greg Ostertag of bounty hunters.
Yeah, terrible at close range and at long range. I think maybe he used a different weapon as like his weapon of choice.
Mm. He's like, oh, I left my real gun in my speeder bike. I got to kill Han somehow. I guess I'll try this one I just bought off the street. You don't want to trust
eBay
for that.
Or maybe he has like some weird, whatever his species is, has some like sword type thing that he uses. But that was in the shop. He needed to get it like sharpened or something.
Or the gravity on that planet could have been different than what Greedo was used to. You never know.
Yeah.
Here's an important question for you guys. Is the name Han Solo just a euphemism for masturbation?
I don't know.
Or no, because they dropped the D. I don't know.
It does remind me I was at church today.
I'm glad masturbation reminds you of being at church today.
Well, I really wanted to make a joke during the Elder's Quorum Sunday school part, because a guy was talking about one of the church leaders staying in his home, and he was sleeping in the bedroom next to him, and so he was thinking about, like, oh, man, Elder Holland's sleeping next door to me. And I wanted to make the jokes, like, so you better not have masturbated that night. but I bit my tongue.
Oh, man, your better angels prevailed, Dave.
Yeah, I think it was the right decision.
But Dave, you really ought to email this guy. Just be like, I didn't mention it in church today, but what I wanted to say, just send him an email, a thoughtful email.
Yeah, I think that might have gone over just as well as, or probably maybe worse than the time that guy John Garlock gave a lesson and was talking about something that he felt like he needed to do. And so he said to God, all right, it's your funeral. And apparently people were really offended by that.
Well, that's sci-fi stack exchange.
Conversation about sci-fi generally does involve masturbation. So, good job.
Oh, who shot first?
I can't handle. No. All right. Hey, what about books, guys? Yeah. Anybody here like books?
I've read only a couple of science fiction books in my life, and both of them are in recommendations from the two gentlemen I'm talking to right now. You know, this Ringworld I'm reading right now, Dave, is because of you. But I previously read Ender's Game, and it was because of Spencer.
It's a good book.
That's beautiful. I'm glad that we can enrich your life in a way that you can go outside the world of poetry and actually find real enjoyment and joy in literature.
Yeah, me too.
So I came up with the idea of an assigned reading segment where we'd assign each other to read books and we'd come back later and kind of talk a little bit about them. What do you guys
that
think?
That sounds great.
It's a good idea.
I love reading. I live to read.
I knew you did. And I know two things about you, Steele. One is you love poetry, and then that's really the only one I'm going to bring up right now. Well, we'll save the other one for another time.
Okay.
So I've got a book for you that I want you to read. Have you ever read a book called Hyperion by Dan Simmons? Or ever heard of this book?
No.
Okay.
I feel like I may have heard of it. Isn't there a publishing house called Hyperion?
There could be. I don't know. I don't care. But this book, it's a terrific science fiction book, but he's written it kind of in the form of the Canterbury Tales. They're pilgrims on a pilgrimage to visit a character or a being known as the Shrike. He's the Lord of Pain, and each person in the book has a story for why they're on this pilgrimage, and it's actually really good. When I read it, each time I finished one of the stories, I told it to my wife, and she thought it was really interesting, and I think you'll like it.
Cool. So how did you find out about this book, Dave?
I love science fiction. I think I was just searching for, like, best science fiction books ever, and they mentioned Hyperion, and it was based off the Canterbury Tales, which turned me off, so I held off on reading it for, like, a year or two, and I was finally, yeah, I'll give it a go. Yeah, it's terrific. There's a number of sequels, and they're all pretty good to a certain extent, but really it's this one that you have to read. I wouldn't say you need to read the sequels and the continuation unless you're really interested in it.
Okay. I'm going to finish the Ringworld Architects, but I'll mix Hyperion at some point.
Excellent.
Well, Dave, I got a recommendation for you. This is probably the most interesting book I read in the last year and a half or so. So I don't know if I've mentioned this before, but my wife, Laurel, started a humanities-type courses that were taught out at a men's prison near us at Oak Hill Correctional Institution in Oregon, Wisconsin. And one of the classes was a poetry writing class that I was involved with. I taught for a couple of years out there. And in this course, we had a bunch of men who had been incarcerated who wanted to do more creative writing, do poetry. We'd have this weekly class. And around the same time, I thought I was especially interested in learning more about the American criminal justice system. And so we started reading several books that would help me understand more about incarceration and about what happens in prison and what prison is like for people. And this book was fascinating. It's by a woman named Sabine Heinlein. It's called Among Murderers. And what she does in this book is she looks at three different guys who have spent 20 or more years in prison for committing murder in New York. And so she describes what their life is like, but especially Each of these guys gets released. They're paroled after spending 20 plus years in prison. And it's about what their experience is like trying to reintegrate into free society, basically, after having been incarcerated for such a long time. So it tells the story of their crimes, but it's merely these human stories of these guys trying to experience life outside of prison after having spent most of their adult life in prison. And it's nonfiction. It's pretty short, quick read. It's fascinating. It's so compelling.
So did you find yourself empathizing with these men? Were you rooting for them, or was it a different experience than that?
I don't know if it's rooting for it, but I find myself, going out to the prison, I felt tremendous empathy for each of the men who were incarcerated and for their victims. I wasn't a one-way street. I'm not like a collector of serial killer memorabilia or anything. I don't glamorize that, and I feel really disappointed about the things that ended up leading these people being in prison. But yeah, these guys, they were human beings, and I felt like the commonalities that I could see between them and myself were between people that I had known, and I wanted them to stay out of prison, to build a life, and to try to do something successful, you know? And just seeing the kind of things they were struggling with and what was a challenge. A lot of stuff I took for granted, but a lot of it was really just eye-opening about what life is like in prison, in a maximum security prison, or having spent 10 or 15 years in prison, which of your social skills erode, and how you are or are not rehabilitated or prepared for life outside. It was really fascinating.
Yeah, I'm really interested in it. I'll get it from the library and read it. I get stuck in these ruts where I just end up reading one particular genre and I have to like force myself out. So it'll be good to leave science fiction for a little while.
Great.
So Spence, we have an assignment for you as well.
I'm ready.
And if I were just to read off of the shared document that we're sharing for this episode, it just says Spencer's assignment is crying.
It really is. Got any more crying, Spence.
Yeah, still, why do you feel like Spence needs to just let that out? What's the deal?
Well, he's got two young kids. He's got a job. He wears a beard. He rides his bike to work every day, even in the winter. I think he's holding a lot in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But in reality, Spence, we picked a book that I loved it. The Crying of Lot 49. And you read
book.
That, right, still?
Yeah, love that. You know, I read it for my prelims for my PhD, English PhD. And you're a big Pynchon fan, Dave.
Pynchon, his books are, I don't know, they're thick, they're very verbose, they're kind of difficult to follow and read. But this one, Spence, it's short, and it's really interesting kind of conspiracy involving ancient postal stamps, which sounds really lame, but it's really good.
Awesome.
It has some of the best character names of all of American fiction. Pynchon's famous for that. My favorite is the nighttime DJ for FUCK radio, or no, KCUF. It's FUCK backwards. But his name is Mucho Mas.
He's a modern Dickens.
He really is.
The main character is Oedipa. She's a female Oedipa.
Wow.
Yeah. Mike Fallopian. That's a pretty good one.
Is he in that book?
Yeah, Mike Fallopian's in there.
Is he the private eye?
I don't even know, but he sounds cool. It's been a while since I actually read this book two or three times because I just really liked it. Watch out for the muted postal horn. It's good stuff. So yeah. We'll read these books and we'll come back later, and I think we'll talk a little bit about what we felt and see if we can do a future assignment as well after we read these ones. Everybody happy with that?
Sounds great.
So we've got a couple more segments. This one is still brought us something. A wonderful Would You Rather quiz. Let's talk about it.
Dave, you sound so surprised when you said, well, Steel brought us something. Like, it's the first time I've contributed anything of worth to the show.
Yeah, this is the only coherent thing I think you've brought so far, so I'm excited.
Well, this is from a much younger Steel, which may explain why. So I was cleaning out some boxes. We're selling a car, looking for the title. Couldn't find it, but I found something that was of even more value. When I was in freshman in college, I was 18 years old, I wrote an elaborate Would You Rather quiz and administered it to like 15 different people and had very elaborate notation for it. Spencer was one of the people who took this original quiz. But in any case, I found it and I turned it into a Qualtrics survey. And I love Would You Rather games. Many people approach Would You Rather as like choosing between two good things. But for me, it's much more fun when it's like choosing between two strange or two really bad things. So most people don't like to play Would You Rather with me. I found this out at work the hard way. But I have a bunch of Would You Rather questions, and some of them I think are pretty awesome. Here's the first one, though. Would you rather change the flavor of your saliva or change the odor of your sweat?
Easy. I don't care about my sweat, my saliva flavor. I want it minty. Yeah, I just want an interesting flavor in my saliva. Really minty is what I want.
Okay. And you, Spencer?
I'm not in agreement with Dave. I would totally change my sweat because I care a lot about food, and if my saliva tasted like anything, I feel like it would ruin the experience of eating.
Oh, totally. Spencer, you're so right. Because Dave's got mint in his mouth all the time. Anytime he eats
Yeah.
something that doesn't go well with mint, it's going to be awful. He's going to lose a huge range of the food.
Yeah, except that for Dave, this is probably good because it means all he's going to ever eat is ice cream.
And that's
Just by
assuming
plain
there is a
vanilla.
flavor that doesn't go well with mint. Like, name me one flavor that doesn't go well with mint, guys. It's wonderful.
What about Jack Doritos, Dave? Would you be eating Jack Doritos with mint in your mouth? I wouldn't.
Oh yeah, a little bit of freshness with your Dorito. It's great.
Yeah, plus your breath would always smell good even after you've eaten Doritos.
Yeah, that'd be pretty impressive. So I guess that's not a bad choice. But Spencer, you changed the odor of your sweat, and what would your sweat smell like?
I hadn't really thought that far. I didn't take the question to be that you could choose what it was, more just that you would have some random change to your sweat.
You would just take it, no matter what the random change was. You
Yeah,
just
because
smell
I
that
would never
rank,
want
huh?
to change my saliva.
What if it was just a very strong Axe body spray smell, Spence? How would you feel about that?
No, that does kind of ruin it.
So Spencer would
But
like
it goes
avoid
along with
exercising at all costs.
Yeah, it goes along with the teenage sound of my voice, so.
Right, so here's the next one. I appreciate your answers for that one. This one is one I used to think about a lot, and I had some strong feelings about it, but I'm interested to hear yours. Would you rather walk to the bathroom at night in a strange house without lights on, or jump feet first into cloudy water?
I'd have to walk through the house at night.
I agree. Cloudy water, I don't know what's in there. Strange house at night. So what? I gotta pee, guys. It's gonna be okay.
See, the reason I ask this one is because even in my own house, sometimes I'm kind of safety stupid, so I don't always turn the lights on. I'm just like, oh, I know where stuff is at. I have hit my shins and kicked stuff and like smashed toes so many times because something was there that I didn't expect. I do it now when I go to the laundry room. We've got a laundry room in a dark basement, and I'm always just like, oh, no, I don't need to turn the light on. I'll just find the door. And I walk into stuff probably every other week, and I'm like, I really should have turned the light on. I hate that feeling.
See, I think this question almost should be changed to having to walk through your own house,
Yeah.
because if I'm at somebody else's house, I already feel like I probably don't know the lay of the land as well, so I'm going to be very careful. But if I'm at home, it's like, oh, I know where I'm going, and then the toy that my 3-year-old leaves out on the floor is going to be there, and I'm going to step on it or something.
That's the thing where it's hard to write that question, Spence, because if I'm like walking in your house with unfamiliar things in your path, then it's like guaranteed bad. I want it to be the possibility of bad. Like, you could jump feet first into cloudy water, and most of the time it's going to be fine. It's just the one time when there's like a sharp rock or an alligator or like a jellyfish that it doesn't work out. It's the possibility, it's the fear of what's there that drives that question for me. Anyway, this next question, I know Dave has strong feelings about. Rather be the captain on an explorer ship or first mate on a pirate ship?
You should just throw this question out. Captain on an explorer ship, you're Shackleton, you're awesome. Or on a pirate ship, you want to be involved with the worst people in human history. I could go off about pirates for quite some time still. I hate pirates. I don't understand why we allow our children to play as pirates and we make pirates seem like cool and fun. Pirates were awful people. It's like, hey, let's go play murder rapists and have fun.
Hey Spencer, what did you give for your answer? Because I'm pretty sure it wasn't explorer ship.
It was the pirate, the first mate on the pirate ship. What are
Now
you
Dave's
talking
directly
about, Spence?
insulted you to
Come
your
on.
face.
First of all, pirates are really interesting. And I don't know a lot about pirates, but I don't think they were all like bloodthirsty murderers. I think they were doing dishonest work, but it was not for the violence and for the rape or whatever else. They were earning a living, you know?
Yeah, and there's
And
some important
there's
political
like a code of
consequences.
honor among pirates. In some ways, pirates are more honorable than like the naval, captains and whatever else.
Whoa, you're walking on dangerous ground there, Spence. I've read probably like 30 to 40 naval fiction books. I love those guys.
Yeah, I don't know how I can respond to that. I guess you're right.
So excellent. I win.
Okay. Would you rather be a Pony Express rider or someone who makes crop circles?
I want to make the crop circles, Steele. It seems like you're going to get in with a group of cool kids. You're making crop circles together, having a good time. After you make the crop circles, you get some sodas. You're chatting along. Pony Express rider, that's pretty dangerous and kind of lonely work.
Yeah, I also chose the crop circles. And I think part of it is that I felt like Pony Express, you're on somebody else's schedule. And you're not like blazing your own trail. You're being told what to do. If you're making a crop circle, there's like some planning that goes into that. You have to think about, you know, where is the circle going to be? What pattern am I going to make? So there's like a truly creative element to it. And as the Pony Express rider, you're just kind of doing somebody else's bidding.
I feel like Spencer's answers are like internally consistent. These last two questions are pretty revealing. Because I feel like if you choose Explorer, you have to choose Pony Express in a way. They're both like, we're performing some valuable service for human beings at the frontier of knowledge. Like, Pony Expresses are delivering information. They're providing some essential package. They're doing good. And a pirate and a crop circle artist, they're both liars and thieves. They're like trying to lie to people. But Dave's like, oh, crop circle in a heartbeat, but pirates are the scum of the earth. I don't get it, Dave. You're a bundle of contradictions.
Everybody's having fun with a crop circle, Steele. No one's like, oh, man, you knocked down my wheat. No, everybody's like, whoa, crop circle. Everyone's enjoying it.
No, they're like, I'm selling my house and joining a doomsday cult because aliens are coming. That's what people are like. They're like living in terror, and they're making terrible investment decisions. And they start listening to Alex Jones, and then their life goes to hell.
Is this from personal experience, Steele? Did you have a crop circle issue?
Yeah, I've been duped, Dave, one too many times.
So are you saying that I'm morally bankrupt, Steele?
No, I'm saying you're consistent. You're an anarchist okay. Who wants no boss. I love it.
I just want to have a good time, Steele. There's going to be, on an explorer ship, there's going to be some real camaraderie. And with the crop circle bros, I want to have bros.
It's the fear of loneliness, then. It's the lonely life of a Pony Express rider that you don't want.
Yes.
Okay. So here's this is a crucial one. This one reveals a lot about a person. Would you rather have contact with the dead or contact someone when you're dead?
I would totally want to contact someone when I'm dead.
I totally agree. I'll come back and tell you whatever you need. I'll talk you through something. But I don't want anyone to come and speak to me. No, thank you.
Now, why not?
It's scary, weird. I think I want to be the one in control of the situation. I want to be the apparition because suddenly this is my deal. I'm in charge. When an apparition comes back and sees me, I don't know what's going to happen. I'm not in charge. This thing could do whatever it wants.
And Spencer, your rationale?
For me, it was purely that I felt like if somebody that I care about were to die, I think I could be okay with that. But I would feel awful dying and having somebody else, I guess, miss me or feel like they could never talk to me again. And so I would like to alleviate that.
Oh, man, that's like the sweetest answer I've ever heard. I can deal with it if someone else dies. But if I die, they would miss me so much, I would need to come back and talk to them. Yeah. Sweet so and egotistical sweet at the same time.
Well, the question really is, would you rather be Patrick Swayze or Demi Moore in Ghost? And
you guys both picked Swayze.
Yeah.
Generally, if you've got a choice and one of them is Patrick Swayze, that's the right answer.
I feel like I should have crafted that question so there's a third way and you guys could have picked Whoopi. All right. Would you rather have T-Rex arms or crossed legs so that they emerged out of one hip but were in the place of the opposite leg? Like your right foot came out of your left hip and your left foot came out of your right hip and you had to walk like that.
Your legs are just traded. They just trade sides is what you're saying.
Sort of, but like if you crossed your legs right now, kind of at the knee, and had to walk like that.
Oh, this is totally different then. I guess I'm going T-Rex arms.
No, I'm going with legs. Arms are too useful.
The funny thing would be like, I could just picture Dave trying to eat. He's got mint-flavored breath and T-Rex arms, and he's on an explorer ship. He's like, I'm the captain! Respect me!
I'm off murdering people and making crop circles with crooked legs.
Yeah, seriously. Your crop circles would be off the chain.
Oh, it'd be more
and
like crop sickle cell anemia cells.
And they're all like, why does this wheat field smell like Axe body spray? These aliens.
It's just the pesticide.
It's just the pesticide. Oh, it's so good. All right, last one. Would you rather have legs to your neck or a torso to your ankles? I'm basically asking to choose between mine and Spencer's body types.
I went with legs to my neck.
You already have that.
Yeah, so that doesn't change anything.
I went with torso to my ankles. I think there's a lot I can do with my torso.
Oh, Dave, you know how much I wish there was actually a human being that had torso to their ankles and T-Rex arms? They would make millions
there is,
in
though,
the circus.
It's Calvin.
From Calvin and Hobbes?
Yeah, he had his torso to his ankles and his arms weren't particularly long.
Oh.
And he brought joy to everybody. Everyone loves Calvin.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, guys, that was a lot of fun. Thanks for sharing your answers with me. If our listeners want to take this quiz, we'll post a link to the Qualtrics survey. There's 50 Would You Rather questions.
Yeah, I think you find out a lot about yourself, Steele. But I was in tears by the end of the quiz. So thank you for sharing it. It's beautiful.
Yeah, what kind of tears, Dave? Joy? Sorrow?
Something in between. And just the tears of a Pony Express rider, I think. Lonely but joyful. And speaking of lonely but joyful, we're going to talk about some songs now. Unchained Melodies. Spencer, what do you got for us this week?
This is a song that I've been wanting to do an Unchained Melody on for a while. I just discovered this band like a month ago. They're actually from around here near Madison. It's just a great song. This is the band Phox, Phox, and the song is 1936.
The blood is all blood too. Feel all of it too, you know. '1936, breathing, and garnet her stone never gleaming. Full of, but she doesn't hear of her grandchildren grieving. No, Elvis raised by our ringling spirit, granted from singing.
It's just a great song. She's got a wonderful voice.
They opened for a band we saw, probably a year or two ago, and they did a terrific job. It was just funny. They're all like 20, and I was in my 30s, and I just felt really old watching them.
Yeah, great music, Spence.
I've got one for us, guys. This guy that goes by the name of King Creosote, he's Scottish. That's really all I got for you, but I think you're going to enjoy it. You'll hear it come through in his voice. This is a song called My Favorite Girl.
Better listen.
I first heard this guy, he did a project with an kind of an electronic musician in England, and it was really interesting. They just took some of his old songs and kind of added different beats and made it a little more interesting. But I like his voice. It's kind of strange, and he brings in some interesting instrumentation, and he's Scottish.
And so many good musicians come out of Scotland.
So many good everything comes out of Scotland, except good food.
That's their failing, but, you know, they're succeeding so many other places. What do you got for us, Steele?
This is a 23-year-old woman, I think. Her name, she goes, records under the name Torres. This is a brand new song called Strange Hellos.
Heather, I'm sorry that your mother diseased in the brain cannot recall your name. Heather, I dreamt that I forgave, but that only comes in waves. I hate you all the same.
Yeah, that was not uplifting, Steel.
But man, when you get that, you can hear the intake and outtake of breath, and you hear the fingers on the frets and slow it down like that. That's so affecting. Torres, check her out.
Yeah, I've listened to a little bit of her stuff. It's fun. Well, I guess it's not fun, but it's interesting. So let's each share another song. So a Blur, I was a huge fan back in the 90s. Brit pop to the max, just great. I love Damon Albarn and all the goofy stuff he does. But they're back. Their last album was in 2003, 12 years ago, and they're about to release a new one. We'll share one of the tracks off their new album. This one's called Lonesome Street, and it sounds like it's like 1994 again. Yeah, it sounds like their heyday again, and it's just fun. I'm ready to hear the whole new album.
Now we just need Oasis to get with it and start putting out competing albums.
No way, Spence. Blur won, okay? Blur's
yeah. Mess. All right, so here's my second pick. This is a song that I just love, love, love. There's a band called Blue Sky Black Death. They made an album with a female rapper named Jean Grey. And it was called The Evil Genius. But this is the instrumental track. It's called Threats. And it's awesome. Danceable, just a funky grooving track. It's involved with Jean Grey, rapper with the same name as the comic book character. I thought issue of sci-fi nerdiness. That was my tie-in.
Thanks for sharing it. And speaking of sci-fi nerdiness, Spence used to play in a little musical group with our friend Jordan that's been on the show before. And you guys would make some pretty nerdy music.
Yeah, we specialized in that. So I picked a song from our immense catalog. This is a song, I can't take any credit for this one. This was entirely Jordan's doing, but this is called Earthscape 2039.
Can't wait for the future to come.
2039 can't come soon enough, huh?
That's right.
Seriously. I don't care if I'm 50-something. If the world sounds like that, it'd be worth living in.
So guys, I'm going to close this down with some book wisdom today. This is about as nerdy as it gets. This is a passage from Isaac Asimov's fantastic collection of short stories, I, Robot. This is a passage from near the end of the book where machines have taken over a lot of the decision-making for humanity. So I'll read you a little bit about some of the dangers we might face when that happens. Stephen, how do we know what the ultimate good of humanity will entail? We haven't at our disposal the infinite factors that the machine has at its. Perhaps to give you a not unfamiliar example, our entire technical civilization has created more unhappiness and misery than it has removed. Perhaps an agrarian or pastoral civilization with less culture and less people would be better. If so, the machines must move in that direction, preferably without telling us, since in our ignorant prejudices, we only know that what we are used to is good, and we would fight change. Or perhaps a complete urbanization or a completely caste-ridden society or complete anarchy is the answer. We don't know. Only the machines know. And they're going there, and they are taking us with them.
Whoa. Machines are going there, and they're taking us with them. Both comforting and horrifying at the same time.
And it's interesting reading this old science fiction, because it's from the 50s, 60s, and they're always trying to project what's happening in the future, and in some ways they get it right, in some ways wrong. But I think machines are taking us places that we aren't necessarily aware of. I think it's interesting and a little scary.
Yeah, and I thought it's interesting the point is made that we've made all these technological advances, but it hasn't necessarily made us any better off. There's some truth to that, you know? We solve a lot of problems, but we also introduce a lot of problems.
It's true. I mean, rather than spending time with my family right now, I'm talking to you guys over the internet recording the podcast, and I think it's awesome, but it also might just be a waste of time.
I think it's probably safe to say that it is both an awesome waste of time.
I'm sure that all three listeners are glad that you decided to have the conversation today, Dave.
Yeah. Well, guys, I'm glad that we could awesomely waste our time this afternoon talking. I'm excited to get back together after we've done our assigned reading and see what we think. But thanks for being on, Spence.
Yeah. Glad I could be here.
And Steele, I'll talk to you again soon, man.
Sounds awesome, Dave.
Off the chain. It's off the chain.
You guys have a good time.
I didn't know anything about any of those questions. I don't know anything about Star Trek. I had no idea what the question was about.
I was hoping you would do something stupid like that, so it was great.
That was kind of the direction I saw it going in.
Off the chain.